Accession number 20145, Reel 2.
Reel 2. Well, then I had a spell of various other jobs. But during my radar part, I was also lookout on the bridge. Now, I can remember one particularly cold, dark, wet night when you're in the open in front of the bridge with binoculars. And you were supposed to report anything you see on a microphone back to those that were in the warmth of the enclosed bridge. And I can well remember one night losing my cool when I suddenly spotted a light off the port quarter, and we were at sea, you know, right at sea. And I reported there's a light, ship bearing so-and-so off the port quarter, and the reply came, "Oh yeah, thank you. We picked that up about a quarter of an hour ago on radar. Thank you." And I thought, well, what are we doing here then, you know? Well, why am I here freezing? And I report something, and some say, yes, we already know that. And, you know, it's some of the things they did in the Navy at that time. And like that, for instance, it kind of made me lose faith a little bit, that thing. But I thought, well, just do it the Navy way, I suppose. But anyway, things were to brighten up. We were suddenly told we were going to have some leave, and I was off to see my first foreign port. I was told the ship was going to leave for Gibraltar to do night flying trials in the Mediterranean. I thought, that was really romantic, you know, this is it, you know, at last I've cracked it after all these years. So we went there, and that was quite successful, but exciting. We lost several aircraft, actually, crashes, and there was one death, actually, and that was a bit sad. But after the trials were over, it was just before Christmas, we were told that we would be home for Christmas leave, and our escorting destroyer, Rocket, HMS Rocket, was going to take the port crew to Tangier for a day on the Saturday, and the starboard part of the crew on the Sunday to do Christmas shopping. That was also exciting, but we had virtually no money as a boy. It was 2 shillings a week, you know, but just to see the sights and things, you know.
How were boys treated aboard this carrier?
Very well fed, but they were really supervised very closely, and were not expected to answer back, or you weren't treated as an able seaman or even an ordinary seaman. You were a boy, and you were made to realize that you were still a boy, even though some of us were now approaching like 6 foot tall, you know. But you were still a boy. And we came home for Christmas leave. I brought some little gifts, you know, and things. But that was just about it. And then I stayed on Illustrious for about 2 years. About that, I should think. And then I had a draft to Drake, and which is in, as you know, in Plymouth. It's HMS Drake. We call it the Stonewall Frigate. It is a dispersal centre, like, for all the Devonport ratings, you know. And they decided that John and I would go to Haverford West, HMS Harrier. It's a radar training establishment where Reddens were taught radar. And John and I both went as instructors, and I was promoted to AB, and I thought, that's it, I've really cracked it now. So I thought it was just a matter of time now, because in Ganges I passed educational tests 1 and 2, and on the Illustrious during school I passed ATT, higher educational tests, which I was quite pleased about, and that meant that promotion to PO was just automatic now. It was a bit of age and a bit more experience, you know. So life started to look nice, and when I got there, I found that my divisional officer was David Attenborough, the wildlife person on the BBC, who spent most of his time out on the cliff watching the various birds, and there were like falcons, what are they called? I forget what they're called, and rabbits and things out there, and because it was very remote, and there were about 30 instructors and about 2,000 wrens. So, you know, and we had dances, and we were well sought after at dances because we were 18 miles from the nearest town. Life, I was there for quite a while, and all the aircraft would fly up from Caldroes to the Welsh coast where we were, and we had mock ships, you know, they were buildings, but one was the battleship, one would be the carrier, and one would be destroyers and frigates and things. So all these mock-ups were crewed by wrens, and we would go around instructing them on radar, plotting, operating, and we spent a good nearly 2 years, 18 months, 2 years there.
Do you have any other memories of David Attenborough?
No, just that he was a nice guy, and didn't. In fact, it was the first officer who we saw very little of. He didn't interfere with us at all. He knew, of course, and got the reports, and that everything was going fine, and the wrens that were coming were learning things and then going, and the traffic was to and fro, and we had classrooms where we would. It was the first time I've ever been the teacher, like standing in front with my desk with a classroom full of giggling ladies, you know. But I seemed to cope with that okay. I didn't, you know, worry to me too much. I did know I had a good grip on radar. I knew what I was talking about, and I knew what they needed to know. So when the exams came, most of them were quite efficient. They were very good. Much better educating them than I, lots of them. And that went off rather well. Joyce came to visit me, my wife then, and stayed in there was just in this place, there was just a row of about 8 council houses in a little pub, and that was it, no shops at all. But she stayed in one of the houses when she visited us, and that was very nice. And then after that period, which I found very satisfying, me and John were sent back to Drake. Once again, it would be the general plod, and we would hitchhike home at weekends to Bridgewater, and then get back on the early train for a Monday morning, and have a bacon butty on our way back to Drake. You know, it got very boring, until that day arrived, what you always knew was going to arrive. You go to lunch on the mess deck, and there's a little note for you on in your place. And it said, Able Seaman Redmond, draft chit. You will take leave, see the regulating petty officer. You're being posted to the Far East on a ship called HMS Amethyst. Of course, the first thing people get when the draft chits are around, anyone ever heard of Amethyst or other various ships, you know, and or Consort or whatever, and someone shouted out, yeah, it's a frigate, Far Eastern Fleet. Good gracious, I thought. And then my wife then had just had a child, our first boy, who now lives in South Africa as a businessman. And I thought, God, she's not going to like this much, you know, a young baby, and am I going away for 2 years in the Far East? But it was inevitable, and John Bartlett, my lifelong friend who I'd met all those years ago on the Bridgewater station, he had a draft trip to the home fleet. He said, blimey, Kip, we're going to be separated. So you are allowed to go back to the chief regulating petty officer if you dare and ask to have your your draft changed, if you can find another radar guy, same rating, who wishes not to go to the Far East, but would, you know, because Johns was for the home fleet. So he changed his draft anyway, and he got on the same draft as me out to the Far East. But he couldn't get on Amethyst. He was on Consort, one of the other ships, or the ship that came to our rescue, tried to rescue us in the Yangtze River later. So we left, we had our leave and bade farewell to all our loved ones, and off we went. And we sailed from Liverpool on the troop ship Lancashire, which was an RAF-run troop ship, actually. And there were soldiers and airmen and sailors on board, of course, but it was actually run by the RAF. And we arrived in Singapore, eventually, at HMS Terror, where I was stationed with John, awaiting our ships who were due in within the next 10 days. So we spent a pleasant, well, nearly 2 weeks looking around Singapore and swimming and in the pool at Terror, which was rather large and nice. And thought we were really beginning to see the world, you know. And eventually John and I shook hands and said cheerio, and I jumped aboard Amethyst with all my kit as the radar operator. And there were about 12 or 16 of us all going on board, you know, where others were leaving. And we were all lined up in the tiller flat. And the various petty officers from various divisions would come along with his list and say, Perkins, Jones, Smith, right, come with me. And he'd take his bunch off. Then another PO would come from another quarter. The stoker, ERA, would come along and pick up the stokers and take them. So eventually I was left there on my own. I thought, hello, no one wants me. I felt quite lonely. Then all of a sudden a young chap come along and said, Abel Seaman Redman. I said, yes, yes. He said, will you come with me, please? He said, I'm just leaving, and you're taking over my job. I said, well, what's that? Where's the caboose? I was thinking about the radar. And he said, you're not going to be radar on board Amethyst. You're the new navigator's yeoman. I said, I know virtually nothing about navigation at all. He said, well, you'll soon learn, because we're having a new navigator on, Lieutenant Berger. And I'm sure he'll take you to the chart room and show you your duties. He said, anyway, I'm off. Cheerio. Of course, he was gone. And there was I. I said, where's the... Before I could say chart room, he'd gone. So I stowed my kit and found my way to the chart room, where I met Lieutenant Berger, who has become a lifelong friend. And he is now Vice Admiral Sir Peter Berger. Very nice chap. And he's coming to our reunion in September. And he taught me about, we had no terrestrial navigation then. It was all sextant work and things. And I was pleased to hear that I was relieved of all general duties on the ship, like scrubbing and painting. I was solely the navigator's yeoman. And during the day, my duties would be to check the chronometers, go about decks topside in the evenings to shoot the stars with Lieutenant Berger, the navigator, check all this, and keep all the charts up to date, which meant we would have radio messages from all over the world saying there's a shallow hulk sunk off at so-and-so, and you'd have to check all these chart corrections, you know, you'd have to go right through the lot and then give them back to the navigator, signed at the bottom that you had corrected it on the chart, you know, the appropriate chart. And I can remember him joking with me one day, because this was all quite new to me, you know. He said, right, Raymond, for the first few months, he said, I'll check your corrections with you, he said, you know, just to make sure. And one day, I hadn't been doing it too long, he said, oh, he said, there's a great improvement, Raymond. He said, you're within 100 miles of this one. I was quite depressed and deflated at the time, but I did learn. I picked it up pretty quick. And then after a while, he stopped checking my work and he had confidence in me, you know. One of my duties every morning as the navigator's yeoman was to go to the skipper's cabin where the master chronometer was kept. And the skipper was always in bed asleep, but I would creep in, check the chronometer with mine, mobile one, and as I tried to creep out without waking him, he would say, "Don't forget to put Simon out, Redman," because Simon, our cat that won the VC, if you remember, always slept in the skipper's cabin. "Yes, sir," I would say, and there were days when I'm sure I was going to make the door without waking, but no, he caught me virtually every day, and I said, "Sir," and I'd say, "Come here, you little," you know, because I was somewhere, and I wasn't the cat lover that I am nowadays at the time. So I'd just throw him out through the door, and that was it, and then go about my usual duties. I'd do breakfast, and then back to the chart house, and then I had a nice surprise one day shortly afterwards. Lieutenant Berger said, "Revan," he said, "you can bring all your kit out to the chart house." He said, and then he had what he called his sea cabin. If he was on duty at night, you know, which was very rare. I never saw him on duty at night anyway. He said, "You can use that bunk." So I was the only lower deck rating with a bunk on board Amethyst. The navigator slept in his cabin, of course. He had a steward who I had to oversee as well. If there was going to be a social evening in the wardroom, you had the appropriate uniform or evening clothes, you know, hung up on the coat hanger. That the Chinese steward would do this, but I would make sure that it was all tiddly and all ready, you know, and he had the right thing. And I got quite friendly with him, actually, the steward. He was quite a nice chap. So I spent most of my time either correcting charts or... And we did a couple of runs up the Malayan coast when that bandit era was on, the war was there, which I was fortunate enough to get the Malayan bar on my Yangtze medal with. And we would go ashore in the afternoon swimming and things, and oh, it was quite nice. But the day, because I wasn't actually on Amethyst all that long, really, just months, just a few months. They say we're leaving Malaya now, Singapore, and we're going to Hong Kong, where we spent quite a pleasant time doing various patrols and things, and having proved to me what a small world this is, because I was alongside one day, broke, no money, tied up in Hong Kong, when HMS Alacrity, that's another A-class frigate like Amethyst, came alongside us and tied up to us, you know. And I stayed in the bows having a ciggy watching them tie up. And after all the dust had settled, a young chap came strolling along the deck, a young sailor, and I thought, I know you. And... as he drew closer, I called across, "Tony, isn't it?" And it's a chap called Tony Brass, a Bridgewater guy that I went to Westover School with down the road as a young man. And he was on the Alacrity. I didn't even know he was in the Navy. Because when I joined the Navy as a boy, I sold him my bicycle. And he said, "Oh, Don," he said, "run ashore tonight to the Fleet Club." I said, "Yeah." I thought he had money, and he thought I had money. We met at the gangplanks in the gate, and we went to the Fleet Club, and we had, the equivalent in Hong Kong dollars would be about, as we said in those days, about 5 bop, you know, 5 shillings. But they were having housey-housey in the Fleet Club. And you, of course, people would never believe this, we played housey-housey, and we won several hundred Hong Kong dollars. And we left there and went to the Union Jack Club in Hong Kong, and we had the most tremendous meal and beer and things, and I later wrote to our local paper here in Bridgewater, the Bridgewater Mercury, about my encounter with Tony, and they printed it. My mother wrote in a letter, "Your name was in the local paper about you and Tony Press." That was quite exciting. But then Tony left, and I didn't see him again till many years later. In fact, only about 5 years ago, in the local Safeway supermarket, and he told me he was very ill, and he died shortly after that. That's the only time I ever saw him again. But that was an experience we shared together. And then came the order, which we took for granted as just routine. The buzz went around, we're leaving Hong Kong, we're going to Shanghai, and possibly up the Yangtze River. I said, well, where's that? You know, and I got the charts out, you know, and there's a several day trip. And we on board then, we took a draft in Hong Kong of about 8 or 10 boy seamen. They were still boy seamen. And one of them turned out to be a lad that was born in Bridgewater, Sam Marsh, who was about to have the bottom of his foot blown off on X gun. But anyway, we had one of these typhoons all the way from Hong Kong to Shanghai, and Sam, who lunched here only a week ago, said he remembers that typhoon. He said, and he spent the whole trip with several of the other boy seamen on the upper deck near the vegetable locker, and they lived on carrots, raw carrots, all the way to Shanghai because they were so seasick. I must admit that it was a really, really bad trip, and I didn't eat what I usually would have eaten myself, so I know the boys were bad. We eventually arrived in Hong Kong, and of course it's the usual run ashore then, you know, so we...
In Hong Kong?
In Shanghai. I do beg your pardon. In Shanghai, it was quite a mysterious-looking place. It was huge, and little babies tied to lampposts in the street with chalk marks on the floor in Chinese explaining why the child was there. And there was a few coins thrown by passers-by where mothers were begging for, you know, it's the kind of thing you wouldn't expect to see in England, like, you know, babies actually tied to lampposts, and the mass of people passing you by all the time, and they all had a look of apprehension because we didn't realize about we were entering a battle zone, and the communist forces were massing on the outskirts of Shanghai. But we just went in the local bars and sat beer, and by exchanging a few Hong Kong dollars for a few pints, the inflation had grown so terrible that we were being paid change in thick wads of brand new high denomination notes with the brown paper still around the centre. And as you were drinking a beer, there was a big blackboard behind the barman who would grab the chalk and rub out the price of beer and then put a new exchange rate within 20 minutes. It was rampant all the time, and you finished up then with a sailor's jersey bulging with you're like all like you had a chest 10 times the size you should have with bulging Chinese money. We thought that was rather queer, and then after seeing some of the sights, I can remember getting to the jetty to catch the Liberty boat back to the ship, who was in midstream, and a little bit of a confrontation with some American sailors who their ship was in, and they didn't seem to like the look of us, and we didn't like the look of them, and there was a little bit of a confrontation again then.
What form did the confrontation take?
Well, just the fact that they were American sailors and we were British, you know.
Well, was it a punch up?
Oh, yes. I think the remarks like, "Oh, look, we have the Royal Navy here," and that was enough. "Okay, lads, this is it." That's soon finished, but back on board, and then we prepared for our trip up the Yangtze River. And none of us, and I can honestly say this, were made aware of what we could expect. The only thing that we thought was rather funny is that there was an Australian frigate there who was due to do the run that we were suddenly allotted to do. And it was told, we were told that the Australian government thought that inappropriate that a frigate should be asked to go up the Yangtze River at this time. Now, to us, that kind of went in one ear and up the other, out the other, when we were told, you're going up, and that's it, so you don't ask why. And we were quite innocent of the fact that, and quite unaware of what we might, what was going to happen. There was a little buzz which said, don't walk aimlessly about the upper decks, because you might get the odd chap or Chinese on the starboard bank, but gun happy when he's trying out his rifle or his gun. So because there's an army there or something, they didn't explain about the politics of the thing at all. So we just carefully and being carefree and talking about the run ashore the day before, set sailed up to the at the river. So off we went, quite unaware of what was about to happen, and there were nothing went wrong. There was no rifle fire from the banks anyway. And the mist on the first evening set in, and because the river is very poor for navigation in daylight with mud banks, let alone at night with fog, we did anchor in a bay alongside some Chinese nationalist ships, frigates and destroyers. But the next morning, a very nice sunny morning, after breakfast off we set, and everything was fine, and I was personally on the open bridge standing next to the skipper, Lieutenant Commander Skinner, the navigator on the starboard side, two signalmen, and just behind me was a Chinese pilot, and everyone was chatting about, you know, the night before, or, you know, the run ashore in Shanghai, and everyone was at ease. And suddenly, about 200 yards or so forward of our bow, there was a huge splash in the water. And I remember the skipper saying, in a typical English manner, "I do believe someone's firing at us." And he said, "Action stations." The alarm went around, and everyone was closed up at action stations. And then we drew closer to the battery that had fired that shell. And there was one almighty explosion forward, where the forward gun was hit. And then there were several other explosions on the stern. And then the skipper had, by this time, shouted, "Hoist battle ensigns, open fire." And we started responding, and just as he said that last command, where my first part of the Yangtze incident goes a little muzzy, and I rely on people that have told me what did happen, because there was one huge explosion on the bridge where we were all standing, and the shell exploded center of the bridge, and the skipper, who was 2 foot from me, was mortally wounded. I was